I do regret that I didn't have kids. That was one major regret. I said, it's the punk top 20. He said, it's the last bloody punk top 20. Why were they employed to do a job for which they have no skills?
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Mike Reed.
When I came to write the autobiography, the questions that I asked, I thought, why didn't I ask my parents about this? As a kid, you just accept things. Now, an American Indian tribe came to the house once. Why? I don't know. But they gave me a pair of half-size cowboy boots, beautifully stitched. So whenever I went out to play cowboys, I had to wear those. I could often be seen going around areas of the garden, crouched over. And I remember my mother saying to me one day, what are you doing? I saw I was talking to Fred, my companion. She said, well, we didn't see anybody. I said, no, you can't see him. He's invisible. He's my friend. Said, okay. But why were you hunched over? I said, I was on my drop handlebar bicycle, which I didn't have, but I wanted. I did a lot of amateur dramatics as well. When I was quite little as well, when I was 4 or 5, we had dancing classes in our house, given by Auntie Joan, who was Julie Andrews' auntie, and Auntie Barbara, who's Julie's mum. Barbara's on the piano with a fag and a gin bouncing up and down on top, and Auntie Barbara, who had a waist, like about 6-inch waist, did the dancing classes. There were, although you don't think about it at the time, I think there were probably a lot of very interesting things in there for me that proved to be useful without me really knowing. So being in plays, being in amateur dramatics, was very much a part right through my school years and college years and beyond. That was, in a way, a sort of induction into show business. So I had that side of it. My mother produced amateur plays and wrote poetry and encouraged my music, you know, playing with your first group and get all your friends around, get your guitars out, make a noise. And my father was a sportsman. He was a great golfer and a great footballer. So I got those two interests from both sides from my parents.
As sweet Polly Oliver lay musing in bed.
Always listening to radio, I thought, pre-teens, 4 or 5 years old, my parents always had the radio on. I was enamoured of melody. I just thought, how do you write magical stuff like this? How these notes fall, even songs you sang at school, the way the notes fall, you know. Sweet Polly Oliver, da 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 da. Wow, I thought these tunes were just magical. I really did. I thought they were sort of westering home with a song in the air. And hymns, I always loved hymns. You know, Hills of the North Rejoice, Non Nobis Domine, Glad the Light of Am I. Oh, I didn't then think about maybe how could I write them, but I knew somehow that I wanted to do something with them, reinvent them. I wanted to have written them or something. My grandparents is where I got a love of light classical music as well. My grandfather listened to all the Dick Bartons, the Paul Temples, all those things, you know. I just heard the tunes. I didn't know, for example, when my grandfather listened to Paul Temple, I didn't know that that theme, Coronation Scott, was about a train. I just heard it, and my grandparents had a panoramic view of the Pennines, and you could often see a steam train taking about an hour ride in the distance to go across. So I associated that tune with steam trains without knowing that it was about steam trains. Years later, when I had to host a PRS award for Paul McCartney, and I was sitting next to a chap at dinner. I did the award, then came down and sat down. I hadn't met anybody else around the table. Like the Bee Gees were there and McCartney. And I sat next to this guy, and he said, Radio 1. I said, yes, sir, yes. And he said, well, what sort of music do you play? Well, pop music mainly. He said, do you play anything older? And I said, well, yes, I do. And here I started showing off. And I said, I play quite a bit of light classical music. I thought, that'll appeal to him. He's a bit older. Do you? He said, what sort of things do you play? And I mentioned 2 or 3 things, and I mentioned Coronation Scott. He said, oh, you play Coronation Scott? And I said, yeah. He said, well, what, do you play the whole thing? Or he said, no, I generally use it to talk over, I said blithely. I put it on, then I talk over it. He said, oh, do you? He said, I hope you register it for PRS. I said, well, I nudged him, I said, when I remember, and he grabbed me quite firmly, he said, you'll always remember, not only am I chairman of PRS, I wrote Coronation Scott, said Sir Vivian Ellis.
The rhythm of the train was inspired from the journey between my country cottage in Somerset and London. So it was really not Coronation Scott, A Game of the Rhythm, but Paddington to Taunton.
Yeah, an old wing commander whose daughter I went out with said, you've got to have a real job. And I had four haircuts and got a job for about 18 months so I could go out with his daughter. It was working in the estate agents. I was still playing. I was going out and playing and doing gigs, writing and written, you know, sort of books, poems, stuff like that. So it was the creative side. But, you know, you're not quite sure how to get in where the door is. And just about that same time that he said, well, if you want to go out with my daughter to get a haircut, got a haircut. Somebody said, oh, there's a job going at the estate agent. Oh, okay. So I went down there. The manager was ill within a month. So I went from junior negotiator to negotiator to running the place, then senior negotiator, then running my own office all within a year. And out of the 25 estate agents in the whole area, I think so there are about 120 people. I was second top salesman the whole time. I'd never sold a house in my life. But at about the same time, a friend of mine had said, oh, could I borrow that cassette of some of your demos? I said, yeah. And he came back and said, my girlfriend really likes it. And I said, that's nice. He said, could she lend it to her father? I said, by all means. And then about 2 weeks later, he said, her father would like to see you. And I said, what does he do? He said, he's Cliff Richard's personal manager. He's David Bryce, Dickie Valentine's brother. So I went round to Templemere, where David lived, and he said, I really like these. He said, really talented. I played them to Peter Gormley, Cliff's manager. Wow. He'd like to see you. Go up to Harley House. So I went up to Harley House and sat there looking around the walls, all these gold discs from Cliff, the Shadows, Olivia, John Rolls, you know, the Seekers. Wow. Wow. And L. Peter said, Mike, he said, we like you. We like your songs. Welcome to the family. Oh, what? This is great. I took a taxi back to the station. I didn't care. So, yeah, so that's how I sort of got involved with them. And so I was in the studio while I was at the estate agent. So I'd be in working with Tani and Spencer and co. They got in to do all the backing. So, yeah, I was in doing stuff like that.
Did you ever have a plan, a dream?
Gradually, I got I played a lot of cricket as well. And I got a call from this guy. I'd met at a couple of cricket matches, Neil for French Blake with two small Fs. And Neil said, Mike, it's Neil. I'd like you to come and see me. I said, yeah, okay. So I popped in. He said, I want you on the radio. And I thought, oh, what, playing, singing? He said, no, broadcasting. I said, well, I've never done it. He said, you do now. I said, well, why? Why do you want me? He said, three reasons. He said, one, you're very English. Two, you're mildly eccentric. And three, you're a bloody good opening bowler. I said, what's the opening bowler got to do with it? He said, I'm starting a cricket team and you're opening the bowling. Right. I said, do you want to hear me on air? He said, no, you'll be fine.
It's the opening of the 2-1-0 cricket season this Sunday against Shipley Cricket Club. Play starts at 2:30. So come and support the 2-1-0 cricket team this Sunday at Shipley Cricket Club.
So Steve Wright and myself started together on the first day, and because our names were Reed and Wright, we thought, oh, wait a minute. And Neil said, yes, I'll put you together, you boys. So we were Reed and Wright, the wireless people, and we were totally amateur. He'd come in, he'd go, now you boys listen to the professionals and see what they do and copy them. And we look at each other and go, no, I don't think so. No, it's a bit old-fashioned. So we do crazy things. He'd drive in, he'd say, what are you boys doing sitting on the curb out in the street? He said, we can't believe we're on the radio. The engineers would run a wire out into the street and we'd say, there's a green mini coming along. Hoot if you're listening to us. They are. They're listening to us. And we'd go outside the studio as well to listen to the transistor just to make sure. We are. We're on. We're actually on the radio. Really weird. We'd go out and check that we were on the radio. It's absolutely bizarre.
That Spanish guitar is so nice. Oh, great. That's On the Border from Al Stewart. Of course, it's Eurovision Day today, and no doubt Reed and I will have plenty to say about that. It's just coming round to 10:08. Here's Clodagh Rogers' incident at the Roxy.
It was an old fire station. Paul Hollingdale was there, of course, who'd opened Radio 2, who'd come in while we were on air, and he'd polished the studio. We said, Paul, what are you doing? We're on air. He said, it has to be polished to a high gleam, the studio. And he'd come in with polish and does it. He said, it has to be cleaned sometime. So, and then we get Vera, the cleaning lady, coming in with a Hoover. She says, I can't help that. I've got to get Ron's lunch. I've got to get back and get his... So we segue a couple of records because the Hoover's going. And then they had great plans for a swimming pool, which didn't materialise. I remember Demis Roussos turning up to do an interview, and he wouldn't do an interview unless he had cake. And he said, I want cake. And we said to him, Neil, he won't do the interview unless he has cake. He said, well, ask the listeners for cake. He said, I'm not buying any. So we went on. We've got Demis Roussos here, and he won't do the interview unless he has cake. The same as people sent a couple of cakes round. You know, one lady who just made a cake. So round came the cakes, and we cut him a slice, which he brushed aside and ate the entire cake.
Ever and ever, forever and ever, you'll be the one.
Day one, David Cassidy flew in. We thought, this is what happens. This is what happens in radio. On the very first day, we did an all-day outside broadcast, and Neil asked for volunteers. Nobody wanted to do it. So I ended up doing it. Nobody wanted to do an outside broadcast. They were all a bit wary of it. Thousands of people. David Cassidy flew in. It was madness. You got, obviously, for the T-shirts and the stickers, you were pulled here from pillar to post. The police had to get me away and drive me back to the station. I thought, well, this is a daily occurrence. This is what happens in radio. You get screamed at by thousands of people. David Cassidy turns up. You get whisked away in a police car, and you're a star. But, of course, it wasn't. Day two wasn't like that at all.
Today is our opening day of Radio 210 Thames Valley, ladies and gentlemen, and we've got an array of stars coming in to the station and also visiting the Butt Centre. Well, we'll be telling you a little bit about them later on, except to say that some of the big names are Mary Hopkin, the Surprise Sisters, Mac and Katie Cassoon, Gary Benson, Roger Whittaker, the Kersal Flyers, we've got June Ritchie, Polly Brown, Peter Skellen, I think we've got Mudd coming in.
It was all fun. Obviously, there was some business behind it, but it was more pioneering. I remember ILR at the time saying they were going to allow 30 radio stations. And I thought, yeah, that sort of kind of makes sense. But, of course, then it went crazy.
Every Saturday and Sunday from 10 until 2, it's freedom right.
Neil Frenchbake, my first boss. But he sacked Steve and myself, Steve Wright and myself, every week.
It's freedom right.
But nevertheless, he gave me the opportunity. And he was more eccentric than I, despite the fact he said I was eccentric. He was more eccentric. And I read the eulogy at his funeral a couple of years ago, and I said, I can't do it seriously. I've got to do it, you know, and Caroline, his wife, said, no, that's fine. And he really was a character. And after the funeral, I said, who are those two characters over there? She said, I'm not sure. They're either MI5 or MI6. Okay. I thought there was something that we didn't know about Neil. He'd phone me from various places in the world and say, you're one of the only people I trust in this world. I said, OK, Neil. He said, I want you to be executor and look after my stuff. I said, you're not going anywhere. He said, you never know. Two was great. I was there for about 18 months, learned the ropes. What was interesting, before I moved to Luxembourg, what was interesting was I did a quiz program. I said to Neil Frenchbake, could I do a quiz program? And he said, yes, but you'll have to do everything yourself. The buzzers, the bells, the questions, the teams. So I did. So at Reading Football Club will come in playing the NatWest Bank. I do all the questions, a lot of music questions and what have you. And it worked well. I did everything, but I learned to make it work pretty quickly. And I got a call one day from Yorkshire TV saying, we're doing a national TV programme called Pop Quest. And Ian Bolt, the director, was driving through your area and heard you doing this quiz. And I thought, that's so unlikely. That doesn't happen. So I said, yeah, right, who is it? They said, no, seriously. I said, yeah. So here's the number, call back. So I did, and it proved to be genuine. So they said, would you come up for an interview? And there were about 12 people there. They were all names. And I thought, well, I haven't got it, but it's going to be a great experience for me. And I got it. And I said to Ian Bolt, the producer, why? Because they're all names. He said, yeah, but you're doing what we need the person to do, which is act as a conduit to the people on the panel, not to be there showing off and being you and being, hey, it's me, it's my show. I heard you on the radio, and that's what you were doing on the radio. So I got my first national TV through that. The same week, we also published the first Guinness book, Tim Rice, Joe Rice, Paul Gambaccini and myself. We didn't know at the time the Guinness book was going to be so big. I spent a lot of time at the British Museum magazine section at Colindale. They confiscated my food every day. They frisked me, I'll have a pork pie. Yeah, there it is. Oh, God, no. So they'd frisk me for food. You weren't allowed food. But it's pre-computers. So I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of graph sheets. So I'm plotting. That was number 37 on this chart. That was number 12. So I'm going through the music papers, doing this graph by hand for months. not just, you know, let's set something up, we'll do a spreadsheet and put it all on there. It wasn't like that. But we had no idea. Absolutely no idea when we did it. It was going to be a success and sell millions. No idea at all. We actually just thought it would be handy for us to have. We thought, well, actually, we'd like this. So if we sell four copies to us, at least we've got it, which is useful. We had no idea it would take off. But he did, and Guinness gave us sort of awards for selling, first of all, 500,000 and 1,000,000. And it was amazing because it did document people's careers. People could look up and, I mean, somebody could test it. You know, Paul McCartney was saying, yeah, I think you'll find Please Please Me. And most of the charts was number one, not number two, you know. And the same with Joe Brown and Picture of You and various other artists, you know, who said, I always thought I was number one. Did it matter? So the Guinness book and the first national TV came out in the same week as I went to do my Luxembourg audition. I couldn't do a tape, so I did it live. And I had to go up to 38 Harford Street, and I sat there and did it live in front of everybody. I think it was Ken Evans and Alan Keane and people like that, the other side of the glass. And I think Alan said, Mike, thank you so much for coming up. He said, we've got about 2,000 tapes to go through, so we'll let you know as soon as possible. Anyway, I got a call the following day to say, could you fly out to Luxembourg next week and start next week? So I thought, well, this is how showbiz works. You have your first book out, your first national TV series, and you join Radio Luxembourg. What's next week?
Mike Reed!
So I found myself, you know, a couple of weeks later, living in another country. I'd never imagined it. And again, no training. I remember going to Lavinia Marquis and walking in to do a programme after Barry Aldis. And I thought maybe Barry or someone was going to tell me how it all worked. Barry said, here's our new boy. I thought, this is Barry. I listened to you under the bedclothes singing the top 40. This is wonderful.
So we're up to the minute on our hit parade programme, coming your way direct from our studios here in the heart of Luxembourg. And here on the turntable is Help! The Beatles' new single straight in at number one.
He said, well, good luck, mate. What? Are you not? No, have a good one. Whoa! And I had to just feel my way into it. And next door there's a German engineer that's saying, can you help? What? No, don't worry, I'll work it out, you know. So, yeah, that was funny. The park there was interesting because I had to walk through the park to get to the radio station. And, one night somebody came up and said, do you have a light? And I said, no, I don't smoke, sorry. And the next night somebody came up and asked me for a light. And I thought, I'm a non-smoker, but everyone's asking me for a light. Why is this? And I suddenly realised the park was full of people that were interested in people like me. And then I saw one guy sitting on a log one night doing something to himself. I thought, okay, maybe I'll take the long route round next time.
Richard and Karen Carpenter, the sort of twosome you may well find on a Monday night on Supergroups, or equally on a Tuesday night on Luxembourg on Million Sellers. Although on Tuesdays they tend to play more golden oldies, maybe some Elvis, some Cliff, some Roy Orbison.
Really, it was a mixture. I mean, punk was coming in. Stuart Henry was there doing This Is the Modern World. And playing punk, he said, and I like, because I'd done the first Punk 20 on radio on 210, which lasted for 4 weeks. It would have lasted longer had Neil French Bate not discovered that I was doing it. I got away with 3 weeks, where he obviously hadn't heard, because he stormed in on the fourth week. He said, what the bloody hell do you think you're doing? I said, it's the Punk Top 20. He said, it's the last bloody Punk Top 20.
That's where I live.
High rise, high rise.
So in Luxembourg, I you know, quite like that sort of spiky stuff, the Jam, and so did Stuart. But it was a sort of crossover period, really, between they were still playing a bit of like Rollers, Cassidy, but it was coming into the spikier stuff as well. But they hadn't completely launched into that, and quite a few album tracks. So it was great just to be there and play a lot of fantastic music and be part of such a famous station, really, because you'd only known about it or seen pictures of it and seen pictures of the Vinnie Marquis and the NME, and then suddenly you're there.
Radio Luxembourg.
I'd done a lot of stuff on stage, so often people locally would come up and say, oh, I saw you in that play. And then I played in a group. So you'd often go and do gigs. So used to people come in and say, oh, you know, so-and-so, that girl really liked you at the gig. Oh, did you? So there'd be an element of recognition. And local radio, again, locally, you go, oh, you're on that new radio station, aren't you? Oh, I saw you in the Arndale Centre. Yeah, so it was a gradual thing. It's not as if you come from nowhere, had a number one, everyone wants to know you, and you're not quite sure how to handle it. I think that it was so gradual that it didn't really bother you that much. Luxembourg's a bit more gradual because you're living in another country. So you weren't actually, you came out of your program, walked down the street in Luxembourg, no one had a clue who you were. And you mingle with expats out there as well. You know, oh, you English? Yeah. Oh, do you want to come around for dinner? Yes, please. Just because you're English. You wouldn't do that here if somebody walked down the street in a high street and said, hello, do you want to come around for dinner? Yes, please. And I remember one guy, John Bond, he said, oh, we got a party tonight. Do you want to come along? I said, that'd be great. You'd only been there a couple of weeks or so. He said, you know, bring your guitar. And I said, really? He said, yeah. Everyone's keen to hear you play. I thought, wow, this is great. I like this country. And I got there with a guitar and there's a frisson of excitement running through the room. And I thought, well, that's good. And he said, you're going to play? I said, yeah, I'll have a drink first and then I'll play. God, he's good to play, you know. I said, well, I'm not that good. I'm okay, you know. And then everyone was pushing in the end, so I got the guitar, sang two or three songs, and everyone was like, sort of, yeah, okay, that's nice, you know. And then he said, you know, so when are you going to play an instrumental? I twanged my way through some feeble version of an instrumental, clearly disappointed the entire crowd, who then dissipated and drifted back to the kitchen. I got in the car and I said, it's a bit strange. I said, they were so excited when I turned up. And nobody really came to say goodbye when I went. And the instrumental kind of finished me off somehow. He said, yeah, I told them you were Eric Clapton. Thanks a lot, John. They were chanting, Eric, Eric. And I thought they were chanting, hey, Mick, hey, Mick. There are probably parents in place today saying to their children, you know, I once saw Eric Clapton at a party and he was terrible. He was awful.
Mike Reed.
I was at Luxembourg only for 10 months. And then I think we were looking for someone at Radio 1, I think. And I'd done a 7-Up hour and it had fallen into the hands of Dorian Davis, head of music at Radio 1. And Dorian had heard it and called me and said, would you come over? And I thought, oh, it was interesting because 3 weeks before I had been to the opening night of Evita. And some of us had been to a dinner in a restaurant, about 15, 16 people. And on the table was Derry Chinnery, the controller of Radio 1. I thought, it's too pushy to talk to him to say, you know, how the day, but he smiled, nodded, and part of the general conversation. As he was going, he stood up and he said, well, he said, very nice to meet you. And I said, and you, Mr. Chinnery, and you. He said, yes. He said, no doubt we'll be speaking soon, and went. I thought, what did he mean? What did he mean, no doubt we'll be speaking soon?
Across the nation, 275 and 285, Radio 1.
3 weeks later, I got a call to come over, and I went to see Dorian Davis, and she chatted and said, look, you know, we're looking for someone for Saturday night. We want to do a little bit of devolution, although it's still national, but on Saturday night we want to do a programme from Manchester, followed by a programme called Discovating, which is a disco programme from Manchester. And I was born in Lancashire. I didn't grow up there. I grew up in Surrey, but I was born in Lancashire, so there was some sort of connection. She said, would that interest you? And I said, well, yeah. Well, I'll go and see Derek Chinnery next door. So I went to see Derek, and he said, well, of course, he said, you're doing 6 programmes a week and earning far more money than we would pay you for one programme. But it's that decision, you know, if you're playing in a championship team and somebody says, we can offer you the job with Liverpool or Chelsea or United or Arsenal, you might not make the first team every week, but you'd be on the bench and you'd be in with a chance. Then it's your decision where you think you've got what it takes to get into that first team, or whether you think, oh, I don't know, maybe I should stay where I am, you know, pay my mortgage, be safe. But I didn't think that. I said, yeah. He said, we'd only be able to offer you one program a week. I said, that's fine. Just generally chatting. And he phoned my agent, and my agent called me later, and he said, what happened in the interview with Derek? I said, what? I said, just chatting with him. He said, he called me, and he said, does Mike want this job? And I said, yeah. He said, does he have independent means? He said, I don't think so. He said, it's a rather dilettante approach to it. He said, most people come in here crawling over broken glass on their knees, desperate. He said, he seemed a bit laissez-faire about the whole thing. He said, no, that's just the way he is. He said he would want it. So the same thing happened when I was at the interview for Saturday Superstore. They were down to a last six. And after the interview, Chris Bellinger, the editor, came running across the horseshoe car park at TV Centre and said, he said, if we were to offer you this, would you take it? And I said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah. We just didn't know. We were talking just after you'd gone. Said, was he that keen? You don't know. But if you're not, oh, please, please, I really want this job. You don't know how much I want it, as they do on X Factor. You don't know how much I want this. I've wanted this all my life. I don't do that. So they weren't sure. I didn't realise I that's how it was. I didn't realise that. I mean, it's like at Radio 1, Dorian Davis said, you're very unusual. Other people go to clubs or, you know, drink quite a bit or smoke or whatever. You go home and take part in croquet tournaments, write something for Sussex Life magazine and have a tea party. She said, that's fine. It's just a bit different. And you come in your old MGTF that often breaks down, whereas everyone else has got a normal car.
January 1970, Marmalade. And reflections of my life. Some more classics from January has gone by coming up in the programme. And I, for one, am very sad. Last night, a UFO streaked across Lancashire and all the fog from Wigan to Bury saw it, and I didn't see it. I'm very sad about that. I've seen a couple in the past, but I desperately wanted to see one last night.
I remember our first week away going down to Southampton. And I sat next to John Peel on the coach, and Derek, always mischievous, Derek Chinnery, came along. We all had little jackets on. We had to wear the jackets with our names on. That was during a, you could not turn up without your jacket with your name on it. And I was sitting next to John, and he said, he said, hello, John, hello, Mike. He said, well, he said, I wonder who's going to be the next John Peel. And John said, actually, in my opinion, Derek, there's nothing wrong with the old one, to be honest with you. But Derek was just being mischievous. As John was himself. I remember going to lunch one time with Peter Powell and Paul Gambaccini. Gambaccini's in the middle and I'm on the inside, and Peel's coming the other way, and he says, hello, Peter. Hello, Paul. Hello, Murdy. It's brilliant. I mean, he's very funny. So, yeah, Radio 1, I remember, you know, when I first did it from Manchester, it was great. I think it took me 2 months to get on air because it was a strike. Am I going to get on ever? I think my first programme was not from that. I think it was sitting in for Paul Burnett one lunchtime. And then, when was it? It was probably October-ish 80 when I got a call. I was in the studio. I did the programme before John Peel, a programme I loved. We used to do a lot of sessions, and I sometimes actually go and play on the session as well. And I got a call from Birmingham, where they got a week away, and said, DLT's got really bad throat and flu. Could you come up and do the breakfast show? Yeah, okay. So I drove up and drove straight into an unlit hole in St John's Wood and smashed the car up. While the AA were coming to take it away, I phoned John in the studio and I said, oh, you know, a problem here. So they're going to come back there and get a taxi. He said, no, no, no. I said, I'll take you up. So when John finished at midnight, we drove up to Birmingham, got to the hotel. The only person up was Roy Wood. So John and Roy and myself sat up most of the night anyway and went and did the programme the following morning, did about three or four programmes. And there was, you could tell something in the air. I don't know what it is. You can always feel things. And you think, And there was a little buzz about it. Anyway, a month later, they said, would you do the breakfast show? So I started January 81 doing the breakfast show.
Good morning, 275 and 285. It's Radio 1 across the nation. It's Mike Reed on the first one. It won't be that exciting, though. Doobie Brothers, and listen to the music.
For the first 6 months, Derek said, you know, almost threatening to fire me from the breakfast show for playing nighttime music. And I said, no, it's not. He said, all these teardrop explodes and orchestral music. He said, it's nighttime music. Because Dave had been playing very disco-orientated stuff. That was his thing, very very much that disco, easy, ABBA-y sort of thing. There was I playing Adam and the Ants and Teardrop and OMD and The Jam. And he said, oh, no. He said, this is not Radio 1 daytime. And I said, but it's just good music, Derek. I got through it in the end and won, but at times it was touch and go. I really wasn't sure whether they were going to keep me on the breakfast show for that reason.
It's Leo Sayer. It's 8 minutes past seven, and this is Orchard Road.
We sort of had a playlist, but it wasn't that tough. I'd seen the Proclaimers on the beach at Portobello when we did a road show, and they had a CD, and I said, hey, do you want to come up and play live? Yeah, I'd love to. You know, great. And so it went, and I pushed him. I said, we've got to play this Letter from America. So, yeah, you'd be out there seeing bands, playing bands, and then they get a deal with a major. So it was quite satisfying that in actually helping bands and helping artists, it was very, very good. I enjoyed that aspect of it. But no, I put it together, and Paul Williams, my producer, generally didn't come in until about 10 or 11 anyway. So it was just me. There's no team of people like now. Like Radio 2, you've got 12 or 15 people working on it, running in and out with things, doing things. There wasn't any of that. It was just you and letters. There was no instant anything. So you letters from the week before, so you'd have some mail. I don't really recall ever using the newspapers either. So it was all much from the top of your head. So it was just you in the studio. That was it. You got in, no team making it easy for you, facilitating the whole thing, or suggesting what you should do next, or how you could be funny. And I really don't get that on the radio. I mean, even the greatest comedian is not funny the whole time. You know, as Bob Monkhouse said, you know, they laugh when they said I was going to be a comedian, and they're not laughing now. You know, you're never that funny the whole time. And that zoo format of like, you know, oh, well, Colin, I see you wearing blue this morning. Yeah, I'm wearing blue. Don't I normally wear blue? No, you wore yellow. Did I really? Oh, it's extraordinary. And you've got buttons. You had a zip yesterday. A yawn. I've gone, you know, terrible. It's just nothing. A lot of people talking about nothing. And I think people get used to the fact that you love music and they trust what you're playing. And if you're, I've had things where radio bosses said, why are you playing that? I said, just trust me. The listeners trust me, so if the bosses don't trust you, then that's bad. You know, you've got to... I remember one station I was on, one of the bosses came in, he said, what the hell's this? I said, it's Clifford T. Warden, gay. He said, never heard of him, and walked out. And I thought, what the hell are you doing in your position, making far more money than me when you don't even know the music?
Gay, won't you let me have a say?
You're not thinking about the magnitude of it or any of the programs you do. It's only in retrospect when people remind you and they say, you know, you were hitting whatever it was, you know, 14 million. So if you played a song, it's probably going to be a hit. And then you had them on Saturday Superstore, 10 million, definitely be a hit. You had them on Pop Quiz, 10 million. Top of the Pops, 15, 16 million. These are massive audiences. But you didn't think about that at the time. I was always honest to myself. In terms of being a writer and a musician, it was... I like that, or I don't like that. And you have, you know, I think someone said to me, you have pretty good ears. You know, Robin Gibb and myself used to chat about this a lot. Songs that should have made it, because they were great songs. Other songs that made it, you think, but they haven't travelled well. What was it? It was of the period. It was of the time. It was the production of the period. So Pete Waterman, great commercialist. You could hear a hit. I mean, Pete and I often sat and said, oh, that'd be great for the Piranhas, Tom Hart. Yeah. Yeah, Pretend, that'd be great for Alvin, wouldn't it, Pete? Yeah, it would. We'd sit there and pick songs for people because we had ears. The Proclaimers, when Letter from America was a hit, you think, oh, I was so pleased for them. You're not thinking, how clever I found them and I did that. You're not thinking that at all. You're just thinking, how delighted. You put yourself in the person's position of how delighted you would be if that happened to you. I remember recording an album at Rack. It Bites were in the next studio. And they said, do you want to hear some of the stuff I did? I said, yeah, okay. Went, you know, calling all the heroes all in red. I said, well, oh, that's great. That's great. So I think you remember that because, you know, they played it to you while they were recording it. And then, you know, a month later you're playing it on the radio and then it's a hit. And you say, God, I remember when they called me and said, come and have a listen to this.
Shooting up the town, boys.
Well, I mean, everything has a life, you know. To everything there is a season, turn, turn, turn. You know, Saturday Superstore had a sort of 6-year, Ready One was 5.5 years. So, yeah, they all have a cycle. And, you know, you move on, do other programmes. The road shows I loved. I mean, my mother calling me and saying, you love it, don't you? Roof down, guitar and tennis racket in the back, getting paid too much, driving from town to town, showing off to the girls. And I said, yeah, I haven't seen it like that. Sounds good to me. And we used to get... you know, the front page of the Sun and stuff like that, and we'd get told off. But stuff you couldn't do now. Health and safety just would simply, there we go, stop. Before you even think about hiring that motorbike in Porthcawl, a Harley Davidson, for you and David Essex to ride without crash helmets, with you letting off flares from the Coast Guard as you drive unprotected through a crowd of 25,000 people that have simply parted up a plank and onto the stage... madness. Everything about that now would be illegal. Everything about it. Uninsured motorbike. A crowd with no security. Rough planks taking you up onto the stage, hoping you're going to stop. madness.
Well, chums, it's got to be poster time. Did you enjoy that, Eurythmics? We have the great light girls down here from Yeovil who are jumping about. They're all dressed the same. And Zoe T and all her mates from Stalbridge or Citybridge, is that?
Day-to-day programmes, you went in, did it, said hello to Simon Bates, and he did his programme. So you didn't really hang out with anybody. Somebody said, you know, a few years ago, oh, you know, the boys' green room and locker room at Radio 1. It was a total myth. There wasn't one. There wasn't a room at all. You know, you had the studio, each producer had his room, and that was it. You know, you came in, you did your programme, you might chat with your producer for a while, have a cup of tea, or pop in and see Dorian Davis, and then you'd go off. So nobody hung around together. The guy coming in the afternoon wouldn't come in to hang out with you, and Simon Bates couldn't hang out with you while he was doing his programme, so it's utter tosh. Dorian was always very good because, you know, now people are unavailable. It was in meetings. And Dorian always had a door open. And it was great because if you wandered, she said, come and have a cup of tea. Come and have a cup of tea. And she said, what's the matter? I said, you know, maybe I didn't. Yeah, I was a bit off the pace this morning. I didn't think it was that good. She said, sounded fine. You sounded very, very good this morning, did I? Oh, and she'd lift you up. Another morning you come in with your tail wagging and she'd say, oh, you look pretty pleased with yourself. Yeah. Yeah, she said, is it a good programme this morning? I said, yeah, I felt really. She said, sit down. Oh, okay. She said, let me tell you how it could be better. So it was very much a Rudyard Kipling, you know, meeting with triumph and disaster and treating those two imposters just the same. She's very good at that. Wonderful, understood. You know, when I was late up with my chum Charlie Spence the other day, and Charlie was saying, he said, you remember my 21st, where I was late for the breakfast show? He said, it's 21st at Spencer House. I was late. Dorian Davis said, he said, why were you late? I said, I overslept. That's all I said. I overslept. The alarm didn't go off. I overslept. And then about half an hour later, when I was mooching around the place, she said, ah, right. Centre page spread. Queen, Prince Philip, Charles Diana, me emerging at 4:30 in the morning, having had a couple of snifters. And she said, ah, oversleep, did we? But she understood that lifestyle, which was great.
July 1964 with Dave Berry's Crying Game and Roy Orbison. It's over.
Mike Reed on your radio today.
Mike Reed on your radio.
We'll be having fun all summer long on Radio 1.
I was taken out for lunch a couple of times by Richard Park. Richard Park was the boss at Capital Radio in London, and he took me out for lunch a couple of times, said in his traditional sports analogy way, Michael, I'd like you to open the batting for our station and do the breakfast show. Fine. And the hint was at the time, everyone knew that probably Capital Radio would get the national commercial license. That was the talk about it. Okay. And Johnny Beerney said, oh, no, you've got to stay here. And eventually I thought, actually, you know, I sort of run the course at Radio 1. Here's a new chance to do the breakfast show on the first commercial station, which is wonderful. So it's like another sort of Philip. As it was, when I went over, they didn't. They decided to buy restaurants and stuff like that instead. And it was the license that somebody else got, and then eventually, by default, Virgin got. So I ended up doing the drive time show there for about 3 years. And I'd gone there to do the national breakfast show, and ended up with the Capital Radio London Drive Time show, which was no bad thing.
On 1548 AM, this is Capital Gold.
While I was there, I must admit, I did the programme after Kenny Everett. And Kenny was wonderful because he'd say, oh, have a good programme, I'm going home to count my fingers. And I got on well with Ken. He's a lovely guy, gadget man. He always had gadgets. And I was driving in one day, I heard the news he had HIV, so I stopped at a florist in Oxshott, bought some flowers, went into the studio, and I said, I bought some flowers. I said, oh, you're still alive. I said, I wasted money on flowers. I thought you were dead. And Ken said, thank God for someone with a sense of humour. He said, nobody's looked in my window for 3 hours and nobody had caught his eye. And he got on the floor, put the flowers on his chest. He said, I'll kill that bloody waiter when I get up there. So he was very funny, Ken. He was great.
Well, Michael Reed Esquire has just walked in, brandishing a Billy Fury LP, an actual LP as well, one of the old big ones. You remember those things, LPs, called, what's it called?
I think it's called... We Want Billy.
We Want Billy.
You Want Billy.
By Billy Fury and the Tornadoes.
Yeah.
Amazing.
A bit of live stuff. I don't have a little bit of live stuff as well.
Oh, it's actually a concert.
Yes.
Oh, fab. Well, we look forward to hearing that. When will the needle be hitting the groove?
The needle will be hitting the groove as soon as I get my brain together. Sometime during the exciting programme.
Jolly good.
I've got a shirt like that.
We are panting.
You know, Richard would pop in. One day he'd say, oh, Michael, going like a train. Sony for you this year. So another Sony award for you. Then the next day he'd be quite different. And then one day he called me and he said, I'll let you think about doing the breakfast show. I said, but Tony Blackburn's doing the breakfast show. He said, Michael, things change, you know. Some people, you know, maybe a yard slower in the box these days, you know, so fine, okay. So he said, have a think about it, we'll talk in 2 weeks' time. And 2 weeks later he had a day full, talking to people all day about programmes. So I was up there first and I thought, oh God, you know, I don't want, you know, Tony to be upset or anything like that. So I said, well, I've been having a think. Oh, my dear boy, don't even think about it. I've made a decision. I said, oh, okay. He's going to tell me I'm doing it. He said, you're fired. I said, what? What are you talking about? He said, you're fired. Don't you understand those words? And I said, but I don't get that. I said, you just offered me the breakfast show. I said, and the ratings on the drive time show. Oh, your ratings are fine, dear boy. The ratings are fine. I haven't upset him. No. We love you. And your ratings are good. He said, just, you know, things change. And I drove home and somebody called Dr. Love is doing my program. And I thought, that is utterly bizarre. But then talking to other people latterly, two or three other people had the same experience. Also, not that long ago as well, I think Kid had the same experience. And Pat Sharp had the same experience. And Paul Burnett had the same experience. I think Paul sat through a whole three-hour meeting and they were given the new schedules. And they said, Richard, look, you see my name on the schedule. Well, dear boys, nobody told you you're fired. Then I moved to Classic FM. Really enjoyed that. Michael Bucht brought me over there and he said, we've done market testing and you test very well. You and Richard Baker test the highest we've had, which is good. It was great fun, something different, something I never thought I'd do. It was different, but I enjoyed it. I just seemed to fit into it and it worked well. I mean, sometimes some of the pronunciations you had to check. He said, do I say this? You know, Henry Kelly was on after me, and Henry would, his pronunciations were interesting sometimes. You know, Beethoven was almost hyphenated. Ah, there we go, that's Beethoven. Is it, indeed?
The corny phrase, which, as you know, we say that to a certain extent we're a rock and roll station playing classical music.
And Lily Bolero became Lily Bolero. Ah, it's Lily Bolero, love. Wonderful. No, I enjoyed it. My producer at the time is now the breakfast show host. We had a terrific time. We went out on the road with a classical music quiz called, I think it's called Brush Up Your Beethoven. Phil Swern put together. I was the chairman. Barry Took was one of the captains and Tony Slattery the other captain. And people come up afterwards and say, how do you learn that script? What script? We're making it up. It was very funny. I know, we're making it up. We're just firing. You know, Tony would come up with the first line of a limerick, I do the second, Barry does it, and we finish it off. It was terrific fun, the classical music quiz. I did a strange little series there with Barry Took. Barry used to come on Saturday Superstore and do stuff with us, and of course he's a great script writer here, Marty Feldman, the Round the Horn, stuff like that. And we did a series we wrote together called The Three Fivers, as opposed to The Three Tenors. And it was the forgotten siblings of well-known people, you know, like Colin Bach, who stayed behind in Wales when Johann Sebastian went off to live in another country, and Colin stayed behind and worked at the local foundry, of course. You know, it was just stuff like that. We just sparked off each other, and it was great to work with Barry and say you'd written a series with a guy who wrote Round the Horn. I mean, that's radio history. It's radio gold. It's wonderful. GWR came in and took over Classic FM, and also gold. So what they did was got rid of a lot of breakfast show presenters, that time-honoured thing, and put me on the circuit. But it was one of those awkward ones where they pretended they came from the local area. So somebody would come through and say, could you say hello to the boys at the bus garage at Bristol? And someone from Bradford said, why is someone from Bristol on our station? And I said, what do I say? Don't say anything. So it was very much, you're suspended in time, you're nowhere. You don't say you're anywhere, you don't say where you're coming from. I said, you know, Radio people are more and more savvy now. They're not daft. They know things. They ask questions now they'd never have asked years ago. You know, is this program voice tracked? Years ago, they'd never have even thought about that. Now they're very savvy. They know how it works. So that was a problem for me, not being able to say where I was. I felt that was rather awkward, actually. And I enjoyed doing it. The problem for me was, when I started doing it, they said, if you can really put the ratings up here, we will boost your salary and we'll give you some points. Great, yeah, get a percentage, this is great. And at the end of the period, the end of the first year, other people were saying, because we all got the same ratings, so we knew what they were, so there was no fudging it. Well done, you've done really, really well. And I kept going back to our guy, oh, we haven't checked the ratings yet. No, no, I know what they are. Oh, no, no, we'll get back to you. So they kept fudging it. And it's what I call the Pied Piper syndrome. You know, 1,000 guilders, Pied Piper, if you'll rid the town of rats. And when the rats have gone, 1,000 guilders? Come, take 50, says the mayor.
Mood mosaic, a touch of velvet, a sting of brass. Oh, that was... actually came out the year before, but it was played all the way through 1967 on the Pirates. It's one of those bits of music you always heard.
Well, I'm then, I don't remember. It's all a haze after that. And maybe not. I did Jazz FM for a while, which was okay. Didn't really... yeah. And it wasn't even... I remember when it was Dave Brubeck's birthday, and I said, oh, it's Dave Brubeck's birthday, let's get Take 5 out. We haven't got that in the library. Hang on. You're a jazz station. You haven't got Dave Brubeck's Take 5 in the library. No, not that kind of jazz. Let's play more Wynton Marsalis or Candy Dulfer, which were great, but it was a certain acquired type of jazz. And I, you know, there's sort of so much smoke and mirrors goes on. I remember, you know, when everyone was looking at Jazz FM saying, ooh, maybe we're putting people off by calling it Jazz FM. So let's spend lots of money on marketing. What do the marketing boys come back with? We think it should be JFM. And that includes, hey, Eric Clapton, Joan Armour Trading. No, Eric Clapton's not jazz by any stretch of the imagination. It was Joan Armour Trading. But, you know, Aretha Franklin. Okay. What's JFM? Well, it's Jazz FM. Okay, well, let's spend more marketing and change it back again. You know, it's really stupid. I mean, why not use the does what it says on the tin?
Jazz FM 100.4, smooth jazz and the soul of the Northwest. It is 29 minutes to 10.
In the shower with Mike Reed. Breakfast on Jazz FM 100.4.
But I think, without question, the fun's gone out of it. And everyone's trying to make money. But the problem is there are too many stations. They've allowed far, far, far too many stations. And they can't make money. You know, if they divided the country up into 15 or areas or 18 areas, that would have worked. It would have been sustainable. But we've had over the last few years so many people handing keys back in a situation where 10, 15 years ago, they'd be making millions looking for an exit route and going to buy their house in Mallorca. And then suddenly it all folded and you couldn't do it anymore.
It's the heart and soul of rock and roll, Big L.
Well, we put Big L back together again, Radio London down in Frinton. Ray Anderson put that back together. There was a lot of passion, a lot of creativity, a lot of love, a lot of knowledge, but not much business acumen, I have to say.
And how are you doing?
Terrible. I mean, when I say terrible, the audience, the programmes, the sound is going great. The revenue stream is atrocious.
So is the station losing money?
It's losing fortune.
That was the downfall. It was a project of passion. And we all went down there and we thought, here we are doing it, you know, the pirate thing. It was great for me. I'd do my programme and I could do 10 miles along the beach. I love that. I do like four or five miles to the sausage sandwich and tea stand and go and sit with my feet in the sea, make all my phone calls. And people say, oh, you're in your office? Yeah, yeah, we can hear the waves coming in. And it was wonderful. I went back about 5 years after we left, I went back. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to retrace my steps, walk along. This is how time stands still in Frinton-on-Sea. I got up to the sausage sandwich and tea hut. I hadn't been there for 5 years. And she said, oh, hello, your usual love, sausage sandwich and a tea. Where's your old mate today? Sorry? David Hamilton, where's your old mate? I said, we haven't been here for 5 years. It was hilarious.
Above a building society on Frinton High Street, Ray Anderson's created his very own pirate radio station, where, contrary to radio wisdom, he lets the DJs play whatever takes their fancy.
Yeah, Harvey Goldsmith was involved in this sort of... really, I think they should have listened to their common sense rather than it was like, oh, great, oh, a TV show, that'll be great for us. But of course it wasn't. It was a bit of a stitch-up. it was meant to be how I can help you to do it properly, and ended up with how I can tell you how you're not doing it properly. And then they had everyone on TV talking about it, which I avoided because I was doing a 500-mile walk and ride from Edinburgh to Frinton for Comic Relief at that time. So they said, oh, we'll send a car to pick you up. I said, no, I don't want to be part of it, really. And they just made everyone look stupid. I mean, one of the guys at the station, every time they filmed, they dogged us for several weeks. Every time they filmed, they had him with a glass in his hand. Well, if you go to every meal, you can do that, you know, and it looks like you're sort of imbibing constantly. And then they went out to try and find as many old people as they could with Zimmer frames and do all that stuff. So it was nonsense, really. It was nonsense.
And secret weapon.
Hi, I was wondering when you'd get around to me.
Former Radio 1 breakfast DJ, Mike Reed.
And stupidly, it could have been good. You know, the premise that they came to the station with, of like, we can tell you how to make the station good and how to make it commercial, would have been more positive and beneficial to other people as well, who go, oh, okay, oh, that's how you, oh, that's clever, that's how you do it. So it would have been, rather than just totally negative, it would have been beneficial to other people as well as to us.
It's always a unique contribution that brings about a blue plaque, in whatever genre it is, in sports, science, physics, maths, exploration.
I was involved with the Heritage Foundation for years, where Robin Gibb was the president, I was the vice president, and two of our senior guys, Leslie Phillips and Nicholas Parsons, used to say to David, who ran it, why didn't you let Mike and Robin take charge? Because they're historians. And David sort of ran his own way. Robin and myself got a little bit fed up with that. I'd been on a few platforms with English Heritage as well, talking about history and plaques and stuff like that. So then English Heritage were stopping for some while. They said they hadn't got the money for it, and they were going to. So I had some conversations, and I said, well, look, you know, the Heritage Foundation thing, to be a bit serious, they keep putting plaques up sometimes for people that may be not worthy, but maybe they should be a bit more judicious. You know, they said, oh, well, let's have a conversation. Then they sort of limped along a bit. In the meantime, you know, Robin and I said, you know, we should do this properly, because English Heritage are only London anyway. They're not the rest of the country. So we formed the British Plaque Trust. We've now done about 100 plaques altogether. And then this last year, I took it into the Commonwealth, because I thought, you know, since its inception in the late 1860s, but it's only been London, I thought we should be doing the rest of the country. And now we've opened it up to the Commonwealth as well. I did the first one in Barbados last year. So that's great. It's a nice sort of philanthropic thing to be involved in, really. One I always found fascinating was Jimmy Kennedy, who was the most successful writer of ours in the States until Lennon McCartney. And he dropped his mother and his sister off at Southampton in 1937, catch a boat in New York, driving back to Weybridge, got lost in the fog, lost the A3, found a pub, that, oh, let's turn around the car park and go back the other way. Picked out the headlights of the pub, and it said the Harbour Lights. By the time he got back to Weybridge, he'd had the song. I see those harbour lights.
I saw the harbour lights.
Which became Elvis' first ever commercial recording. So Elvis' first ever commercial recording was about a pub near Portsmouth, which I always found fascinating. I always loved songwriters. I always looked at the names in parentheses under the song. We all knew the singers, that's fine. I always looked at the song. I thought, it's them again. I don't know who they are, but they're really, really good. And one of those songwriters was Jerry Lawden, who wrote Apache, wrote Wonderful Land, wrote A Girl Like You. Very, very good songwriter, Jerry. When the Showbiz football team came to the next village to us, I cycled down there and Jerry Lawden was playing. There were pop stars playing, couldn't tell you who they were. And I was a little kid and I cycled down there and I found him coming off the pitch. And I gave someone a camera. I said, excuse me, Mr. Lawden, may I have a photograph? And he said, yes, of course. Probably delighted, because no one else apart from me probably knew who he was. And Jerry was quite diminutive, but I was even smaller at the time. And you can see, even on a black and white photograph, that I'm blushing. So for me, unveiling the plaque for British Music Day in 2017 in Jerry's hometown with his wife and some of the people that played with him over the years was wonderful. I actually unveiled the plaque and told the story, which for me was very, very special. Very, very special. Radio is a pretty boring business. The reason now we started United DJs was simply because everybody was saying we're doing a job we love in a way that we don't. You know, we're told what to do, we're told what to say, we're told how to do it. That's appalling. I mean, really, if you can't trust the guy this side of the microphone to do it.
Keith West, an excerpt from a teenage opera. Got to number two, pushed heavily, of course, by the Pirates.
Legendary music, brought to you by legendary voices. We are UDJ, United DJs.
I mean, somebody said to me recently, you know, no names, no pack drill, that they went into a studio and there's somebody sitting there, a famous person. They said they didn't know how to work the desk, they didn't know anything about the music, and they weren't sure what to say. And I said, why were they booked then? Why were they employed to do a job for which they have no skills? It'd be like sitting me in a Formula One car and saying, go on then. Well, I don't know how it works. You know, it's madness. Madness.
8:13, and time for school desk. We won't have a little thing that goes, ding, 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 school desk. Would you please give a measure to North London Collegiate School in Edgware, Middlesex?
People always say you shouldn't have regrets, but you do. It would be inhuman not to have regrets. I don't get where people say you should never have regrets. You do. It's difficult. It's another show in itself, really. I do regret that I didn't have kids. I've got two lovely godchildren who are 13 and 11 who are brilliant. I do regret that I didn't have kids. That was one major regret. Apart from that, I don't know. I mean, there's loads of things you want to do. It's not a regret. It's still stuff you want to do. Bad decisions. I made a few bad decisions here and there. Then you surround yourself with people who help you make those bad decisions. That's not good. So, yeah, I think if I'd had a very long-term right partner who said, no, listen, just let's have a glass of wine, stop and have a think about this before you do it, before you career off on this direction or career go, oh yeah, let's do this, let's do that, and you're on board the train. It would have been good to have a sounding board, a long-term permanent sounding board, who said, no, just let's think about this before we do it.
Wow, the week we've had on the road show, which has been great fun. Out on the road again in early September.
How would I like to be remembered? I'd like people to find out loads of things about you that they didn't know and go, oh, I didn't know that. That's a surprise. I didn't know that.
For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.